I want to talk about who are we? Who are we as a nation? What is our essence after 2,000 years in exile, after 2,000 years of persecutions of one sort or another? We came back to Israel, we came back to the land of Israel. What for? What are we here for? What's our essence? What are we supposed to be doing here? And where maybe we've gone off the tracks and we have to get back on the tracks? And why did we get off the tracks? What's basically happened here? So I just like to start with a small midrash, which is maybe a bit connected to Shavuot. There's a midrash that says something like this, you know, the brothers were selling off Joseph. Jacob was basically trying to find some peace being in Israel. Judah had a funny relationship with his daughter-in-law. And what's God doing? He's creating the messianic light. So I just want to try and understand what this idea means. We're going to be reading in a couple of days' time the story of Ruth. Now, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who was a former chief rabbi of England, he brought out an interesting idea. He says, there's a word in English called ruthless. And that word, as you all know, is a combination of two words, ruth and less, meaning without ruth. And there was formerly in the English language, a long time back, a word called ruth that basically meant compassion. Basically coming from the word ruth. And what I'm trying to basically say is that what happened when, after Yehuda had a relationship with his daughter-in-law, so two children were born. One was called Peretz and one was called Zerah. And Zerah was a twin, and Peretz and Zerah were twins, and they say the story was that Zerah was supposed to be born first, and Peretz somehow got out first. And they said, how comes you got out first? They said, Ma paratzta, you broke through. And then they said that the messianic lineage comes from Peretz. Why? Because he broke through the wall. He broke through the wall. In other words, as if to say that the messianic power, the king's power, is to break through the wall and create a new way. In other words, not to be frightened of the wall and to break through that wall. Now, I would like to suggest that messianic power that we want to break through the wall, first of all, we find out what that wall is basically the power of compassion. I'm saying that is the power. I want to show you a couple of examples why the power of the compassion is the power that breaks through the wall to make us who we are. Not that it's not important other things, but that's for compassion. I'll give you an example. The Jewish people go down to Egypt after the story of the sale of the brothers. Now, who gets us out of Egypt? What is the power that gets us out of Egypt?
Hunger.
Sorry?
Hunger.
Again?
It's in Egypt.
What is the power? We know the story. The Jews are being persecuted in Egypt. And then a young girl goes down to the Nile and she sees a baby. But what does she do? She has compassion. You can have as much compassion as you want. You have a regime that has decided that every child shall be killed. Now, who are you to go against that regime? It's a big regime. It's not a little thing, you know. Now, not only does she save the child and go against the regime, but she has the audacity to bring the child into the king's palace and educate him for his mission. That is total audacity. Now, where does she get that power from? You understand what I'm saying? She breaks every single possible rule. She doesn't just save the kid. She doesn't only bring him up in order that he should have the same compassion that she has when he will eventually go out to see his brothers. Where does she get that power from? Do you understand my question? I mean, it's pretty crazy, you understand? I mean, she goes against the whole regime, then she says, bring me back the child because I am the one who has to educate him, not the mother. I'm going to educate him. So she insists not only to save the child, but to educate the child. And she wants to break through the barrier in order that this guy that she is bringing up will actually take the people out of Egypt. That's a pretty big thing, no? And what does she do it with? With the power of compassion. So what is that power? I would like to suggest that power is the essential power of the soul. That power is so powerful that if you want it, it's the God in us. It's Chelek Eloka Me'al in us. That is who we really, really are. In other words, she feels so powerful because she feels the God in her. She feels that soul in her. That you talk to her logically, one second, there's a regime here. You can't just do what you like. She doesn't feel threatened. She doesn't feel that anyone can threaten her when she is basically representing a godlike power. Do you understand how powerful that is? Now, I'm a student of what happened to the Jewish people in the last 2,000 years, and especially in the last 100 years, and especially what took place to us in Europe. I believe, and this is the trauma that basically governs my life, that we abandoned our brothers. We abandoned 6 billion Jews, and we could have saved every single one of them. No Jew should have been killed, no one, if we hadn't abandoned them. So when we abandoned them, why did we, how did we abandon them? Because those people who were going to be murdered, we didn't feel compassion. What is compassion? Compassion doesn't mean, oh, I feel for you, I'm really sorry for you, you know, it's, I mean, I really can't do anything about it, you know, because I can't save you, because I don't have the power to save you. Compassion is when you get so involved with who you are, have compassion for, that there is no difference between you. He and you are one. And then you feel an incredible power. Or what we say in Hebrew, in the verse, Ve'ahavta l'ro'echa kamocha, Anochi Hashem. When you love your brother like yourself, you feel a godly power. You feel that nothing, but nothing can stop you. There isn't a chance in a billion that you can be stopped. And so when Raoul Wallenberg goes to save 100,000 Jews, how does he do it? So when he's asked the question, well, you're a young guy, you know, you've got no real experience, how do you think you're going to do it? Well, nothing's going to stop me. Now, how can a guy say nothing will stop him? There are Nazis there, they're the A's of the Nazis. I mean, nothing will stop you. You're not living in a cuckoo land. There's armies out there. What do you mean nothing's going to stop you? How can a guy say that nothing will stop him? So he says something like this. I have an incredible power, and that power is my imagination. So what does that imagination allow him to do? He says, when I got to Budapest, I saw Jews going to the trains. And I asked myself, what do they feel when they go to the trains? You know, they've just been telling him that you can't save all the Jews that you want because you've got too many powers against you. So, one second, I'll tell you how I can save all the Jews I want. No one's going to tell me what I can do. He says, it's very simple. All I have to do is understand what a Jew feels when he is going to the trains. He doesn't ask who's the enemy, how many Nazis there are, how many Nazis there aren't, how are we going to do it. He doesn't start with the technical. Of course, you've got to tackle the technical at some stage. But right now, you've got to understand how he knows he's going to succeed. Of course, there's a technical part to everything. But first of all, how does he know? He says, what does a Jew feel when he's going to the train? Basically, if a person is going to the train and he is surrounded by different people who hate him, what would he like to happen? What would be his dream? What would be his thing? You know, if you're surrounded by hate, right? So what is the most important thing in your life when you're surrounded by hate? To meet somebody who? Who loves you, who cares for you, right? That's the only thing you care about. You don't care how bad a Nazi is or how bad. You want to meet somebody who cares for you. And so Raoul Wallenberg sees these Jews going to the train and he imagines himself going to the train. Now, what would he have been doing if he was going to the train? He would be saying, well, look, brother, where are you? When are you going to come and save me? In other words, Raoul Wallenberg can hear people saying in their hearts, when is my brother going to come and save me? When are you coming to save me? So just imagine that you hear somebody going to the train saying, brother, when are you coming to save me? So what happens to him when he hears that? Is there anything that can convince him that he can't save them? Nothing. Because he's heard their cry. When you hear somebody's cry, that empowers you. That empowers you to do whatever you have to do. Nothing can stop you. Everything else afterwards is technical. He gets on the train, he gets this, he gives a certificate, he gets that, he shouts at a narcissist, he threatens them, he does what he has to do. But where does that come from? It doesn't come from saying Hitler's a bad guy. It doesn't come from saying Hitler's is a Russia or a wicked man. It doesn't come from being an intellectual who says, yeah, the Nazis are bad guys. It comes from asking yourself a real question. He hates. Do I love? And if I don't love, then I am not on the opposite side of Adolf Hitler. Now, what am I trying to say in two words? Is that compassion is the greatest power of the Jewish people. And we came to the land of Israel in order to learn the art of compassion, in order that we can give our light to the world. That's what we're here for. That's why we came here. That's what we've done.
I'm just wondering, sometimes I feel like there are certain things that prevent me from feeling compassion. Like, for example, the commandment to hate Amalek. How would you respond to that?
Let me put it simply. Let me make what you're saying much more practical. Okay? And because I don't know who is Amalek, right? So I want to make your thing practical. Say I take now a really bad terrorist, okay, who wants to come and kill Jews, right? And I know he's on a mission to come and kill Jews. Now I have to show compassion to him. How do I do that? He's coming to kill Jews. So, first of all, if he's on his mission to kill Jews, obviously I have to kill him first. Where's the compassion? I just killed the guy who came to kill us. Okay, I did have to do. What is my now? Now the compassion is for that I kill him before he kills Jews. So maybe upstairs he'll be tried for wanting to kill and not actually killing. And now where's the real compassion? I've got to now really have compassion for him. But I've just killed the guy. But I've got to imagine him 20 years ago when he was a boy of 3 or 4. And now I've got to go to his child or to children of 3 or 4, Palestinians, let's say, and give them a chance of another education. Give them a chance of a Sufi Muslim education which has a moral, humane ingredient to it. I've got to create a whole school where I train 10,000 teachers like that, who will give the Palestinian child another education so he doesn't grow up to be a terrorist that I also go and kill. I'm not saying I'll succeed in every single one, but I'm saying that is what I will offer. And I will offer that every day. And if I don't succeed and you come and you want to kill me, of course I have to kill you first. But the idea is that I have to know that that person who is now coming to kill me, he received what I would call an Amalek education or a hate education. And therefore he became what he became. But if I would have taken this child 20 years ago and given him another opportunity of an education, then things could have been different. And that is the Jewish peace plan, or what we say in our books, Hillel Omer, Hevemi Talmidav Shel Aaron, Oev Shalom, Rodev Shalom, Oev Et Abriot Umekarban LaTorah. When you love somebody, you want peace. You plant seeds of peace. You want to bring him to the Torah. Not to my Torah, to his Torah. He was born in God's image, therefore he should be doing at least 7 mitzvot, at least the mitzvah of not killing somebody, at least the mitzvah of the sanctity of life. So I teach him that through his religion, which has that ingredient, not the jihadistic, not the jihad Islam, but a Sufi Islam, which is has almost no influence today. But if we would invest $1 billion in making a massive, giving power to the Sufis, and create a massive seminary where you train teachers and you make schools and universities in that vein, and you give, you invest a lot of money in that, then of course it will have an influence. But as long as you try and make deals with people who have no morals, whether it's the present leadership of Hamas or the present leadership of the PLO or the present leadership of Ashraf, of course you're going to get nowhere. You've got to plant seeds. That child who I go and kill, he got an education. So if I have compassion, I've got to start, you know, and it's not just compassion for him, it's compassion for me. Because if he comes to kill me, I go and kill him, one or twice he's going to succeed, and I'm going to, I don't want my children to be. That's compassion. In other words, the word compassion in Hebrew is chenla and rachamim. The word rachamim comes from the Hebrew word rechem, the womb, which gives life. It doesn't just give life, it preserves life. So when I say basically that compassion is the power that has to break through the wall, I'm also talking about breaking through the wall of indifference. And I'm talking about breaking the wall, what the Bible calls the heart of stone. We have to break through that wall. And you can only break through that wall when you have the power to imagine how you would feel. So the daughter of Pharaoh, she feels how she would feel as a mother if that was her child. And she brings it up as her child, and the Midrash says, therefore God calls her not the daughter of Pharaoh, but my daughter, Batya. Because you felt as if it was your child, personally your child, and therefore you did what you did. And she doesn't only save him, she educates him in order that he would have the power to go out and look at the suffering of his brothers and become who he is, because he had the power to look at the suffering of his brothers and feel their suffering and then do what he has to do. And now, basically, I want to talk to you about the exact opposite. What happens if you suffer for 2,000 years, you come back home after the biggest tragedy that you could possibly, what happened, and you create a state, and you create functions, and everything is going fantastic. You have an army, you have an infrastructure, you have everything going great, you have a technology, you have high tech, you have everything's fantastic, you have modern things, everybody's coming to see, and we, it's as if we've succeeded. Is that the truth? 3 years ago, I found out something that has shocked me so much that since then my life has changed dramatically. I was reading an article on one Shabbat in a newspaper about a group of rabbis who went to visit the prison in the south called Cholot. In that prison, there were groups of Eritrean people who had come to Israel either because they wanted a job or either because they were fleeing persecution. I'm not going now to decide what they were, I don't know. But they went to visit the groups of Eritrean people in this prison to see what the situation was. And at the end of the article, it was written a sentence that didn't just trouble me, but it basically caused me to do a research to find out if what I was reading was true or not. And basically what it said was, you cannot expel the Eritreans back to Eritrea, because if we expel them back to Eritrea, they are likely to be murdered, and not only murdered, but murdered by our weapons that we sold to Eritrea. Now when I read that, that for me was something that I had to find out about. Is this true? I could not imagine that I, and let me be clear, I am responsible. If my nation, whether it's the Prime Minister or the government, is selling arms to a murderous regime, that makes me responsible. Why am I more responsible than the Prime Minister of Israel? Because I know exactly what that suffering involves, the people that kill mass, but I think I know what it is because I'm not afraid of imagining how I feel in that situation. And because I'm capable of imagining what I would feel if it was me, or how it was me 75 years ago, then I am responsible. No less than the Prime Minister, probably much more than the Prime Minister, because I know what that suffering entails. Now, it's quite probable that the Prime Minister has not taken the time to imagine that suffering. Consequently, what I found out in my research is that we have been selling arms to the worst people in the world for the last 30 years and more. We sold arms to the murderers in Rwanda, a left-wing government in Israel led by Rabin, Peres and Yossi Sarid, sold arms to the government in Rwanda that massacred 800,000 people 24 years ago. In other words, after the massacre had started, planes left Ben Gurion Airport full of arms for the murderers. Now, there have been in the last 2.5 years, there have been two appeals to the Beit Mishpat Elyon, to the high courts in Israel, in order that this information should be revealed to the Israeli public, in order that we, the Jewish people, can do what we call cheshbon nefesh, a bit of self-searching, and stop doing this, right? Now what happens when it gets to the High Court of Justice? The High Court of Justice will be told they're not exactly right-wing people, a lot of them are left. And when it comes to them, they say, listen to me carefully, that the right of the Jewish people to know what happened does not supersede the interests of the State of Israel. In other words, the interests of the State of Israel that this information should not be revealed is so important. 24 years ago it happened. We're not talking about now what happened today. I'm talking about something that happened 24 years ago with a country called Rwanda, which is not exactly Israel's lifeline. And we cannot reveal it to the Jewish public in Israel because our right to cheshbon nefesh, our right to self-searching, is much less important than Israel's interests. So I want to know what interest is more important to Israel than the fact that we should get back to ourselves. Understand what I'm saying? Now, basically, what's going on here? So, as I said, I found about this 3 years ago. And at that point, when I found about it, my first granddaughter was just born. And she's now 3 years old. And she goes every day to a gun. How do you say it? You know, it's kindergarten. And what happens in the kindergarten if a child starts becoming violent? What does my grandchild expect should happen? She expects that the person who's in charge of the kindergarten should take the child who's becoming violent on the side and calm him down, right? Isn't that what is expected? It was my grandchild, and my daughter sends her child to a kindergarten knowing that if something happens there's someone responsible who will take the little child away and calm him down. Certainly they won't give him a knife or a stick or something else to go and hit the children. I mean, would you send your child to a kindergarten where the kindergarten teacher gives a child who is becoming violent a big stick to become even more violent? Obviously not, right? In other words, my grandchild has never ever learned law. She's 3 years old. She hasn't gone to law school. She doesn't know anything about law. But she knows that if a child becomes violent, she knows automatically the kindergarten teacher will come and take her and calm him down. But she's never learned law. She never went to law school. And you've got judges that all went to law school, and they don't understand what my grandchild understands. What's going on? What's going on here? In other words, we have a notion in law which is called tomlev, the purity of the heart, the innocence of the heart. If you don't do something in an innocent way, something is wrong. In other words, they can write a judgment saying it is not in Israel's interest that we reveal this information, therefore we will not reveal it, and the right of the tzibur, the right of the people of Israel to cheshbon nefesh, to soul searching, is much less important than so do you understand what's going on here? In other words, there's nothing true. You've lost the purity of the heart. You've lost the innocence of the heart. So when I go and speak to rabbis, and I tell them, look, we're doing something terrible. You've got to open your mouth. You've got to shout. What do the rabbis say? But even the high courts of justice, which are left wing, even they're against you. And now they've also got an excuse not to open their mouths. Because the high courts of justice are there against us. So who am I to say, do you understand? So what have we done? We have silenced the problem. To the point that you have maybe 100 different reporters trying to find out how much champagne Bibi did take or did Bibi didn't take, or how many bribes he did take or didn't take. And here on something that is to help mass murder, nothing. Nothing. So for instance, today, you have a country like South Sudan who have massacred well over 50,000 women and children. They receive arms and training from us. And Nikki Haley, as you all know her, is the United States representative of the United Nations, and she asked the Security Council to create an embargo on South Sudan, on Myanmar, on other countries where there is mass murder. And what happens is that in the Security Council, Russia and China oppose, and consequently, they quash the demand. Because Russia and China oppose, and there is no decision by the Security Council to have an arms embargo on these countries, Israel feels that they go according to international standards when they carry on arming these mass murderers. So we have decided that our moral level should be under the Security Council, which is basically under Russia and China veto. America have decided that this is too much for us. We are not going to arm South Sudan, even though the Security Council allows us to, because we know what goes on there. In other words, America has a process of receiving the information from people in there. They see what information there is about different mass murders being going on. Just that you should understand, they go into the villages, they rape the women, and then they murder them. Women, children, everything. And that's what took place a couple of months ago in Myanmar. And 2 days ago, I read in the Guardian, in the British Guardian, that there is a new mass murder going on in Myanmar, this time not against the Rohingya Muslims, but against a Christian minority there in the north. And there they started now a mass murder on that one. And it hasn't reached most of the international press. But the Guardian brought out a massive report how already 7,000 refugees have run away after there has been massacres of women and children in some of the villages. What am I trying to say in two words? Have I the right to turn away and say, I don't know, I don't see, I have nothing to do with this? I believe that what I sow is what I reap. If I sow help to mass murderers, that's what I'm going to reap. That same Russia that gives me the right to sell arms to all these murderous regimes are today arming my enemies. And not only are they arming my enemies, but they may well be involved in a future fight against a new future war against Israel. Now Bibi can go and see Putin 10 times a week. Putin is not only a murderer, he is a person who bluffs his way. He is living on the brink. And he has one interest, Putin. And he wants to become a power here. And he is becoming a power by selling arms to our enemies, Hezbollah, Iran, and other Arab countries who could become our enemies. He's now making an alliance with Turkey, and I don't know what's going to happen still with North Korea and China in this equation, but it does not look good. What I sow is what I will reap. So of course I do care about the child in South Sudan, and I also care about my grandchild, who I don't want her to inherit these crimes. I don't want her to inherit the result of these crimes, which means eventually hate will come back against us. So I'm trying to run a campaign at the moment to stop this. As you can imagine, the most important thing that people try and do when I run a campaign like this is what? To ignore me. Today I know that I have to force them to fight me, to fight what I'm trying to stand for. Because as long as they ignore me and they succeed in ignoring this cry, then basically the cry doesn't exist. And that is basically what I'm saying, is that when we behave in a ruthless manner and we sell our soul for money from mass murderers, that is spiritual suicide. And that spiritual suicide can bring on a much worse thing, literally, that we put the whole of the Jewish people in mass danger. Because when you deny who you are, then you put yourself in mass danger. You open yourself up. I'll give you an example. 7 years ago, a few children in Syria wrote some graffiti on the walls against President Assad. As a result of that graffiti, some of the children were caught, they were persecuted, and after that started a revolt against Assad. At the beginning of that revolt, Assad murdered thousands of his people. At that time, if we would have had that compassionate power, we would have made it very easy to take Assad down and have a new regime in Syria, which was based on liberal forces. We didn't do that. We looked from the side and we didn't do anything. What do we have now? Putin is there, Iran is there, Turkey is there, and all that force could well very soon be all against us. What am I trying to say? That when you are you, when you are the humane, compassionate you, that is also your supreme interest. There is no interest above our values. Our values and our interests are the same. If you say our interests are one, but our values are not, and the interests are more important than your values, then you are living in cuckoo land. You are blind. Just like we were blind in the Holocaust when we could have saved our brothers. And we should have saved them. If Herzl would have been alive, he would have taken every penny there was in the till. He would have gone to get more pennies, and he would have bought an island to save the Jews if we can't bring them to the land of Israel. That's what he wanted to do in Uganda in 1903. He didn't want Uganda instead of the State of Israel. He wanted Uganda as a temporary shelter. The Zionist leaders at the time said, what can we do? We can't bring them home to Israel. It's not our problem anymore. 6 million went. There was no problem to save 6 million Jews. None at all. But you've got to have the power of compassion. So what am I saying? Well, you don't have the compassion for your own people. You don't have compassion for people in South Sudan, and you don't have compassion for your own children and grandchildren. The lack of compassion is the lack of the essence. It's the lack of who you really are. And our Judaism in the state of Israel is a Judaism of laws that often is without compassion. And consequently, our rabbis are conspicuously silent on this issue. As if it doesn't concern them. It's not their problem. So you can imagine what fight have to fight. The rabbis ignore you. The Knesset ignores you, left and right, because a lot of the left wing former generals have created arms companies, and consequently they're involved heavily in this. The right, the left, the professors at university, nothing. So you have an incredible crime that has been going on for over 30 years, that we are arming mass murderers all over the world. They go into towns, they kill mass murderers, and the Jewish people are quiet, nothing. So now what I say is compassion. Compassion is two things. One, you are compassionate for somebody who is suffering physically. Secondly, you're compassionate for somebody who is suffering spiritually. I believe, I go often to prisons to teach there, and I believe we're all in prison. We all are in the prison of the soul. The soul, that bastion of compassion, is in prison. So I always write, when I write my articles, I always say, I believe we will wake up to the compassion in us. I don't say we have to wake up to who we are. We have to have compassion on our own people that we have become so indifferent. But we have to awaken them and tell them, this is not who you are. This is not who we are. This is not who we are supposed to be. And we have to show them the power of compassion, that we will go to your meetings and we will not allow you to speak until you address this issue. So now I do it, and I'm sort of some sort of Don Juan, some sort of nutcase who goes to meetings of different politicians. Last night it was in Bnei Brak, some with Gilad Ardan and Tzachi Hanegbi, and somewhere else. What I'm trying to say, they have to be aware that there's not just one nutcase here who wants to destroy. They have to be aware that we as youth cannot accept this. And when they begin to understand that they have a fight with the soul of the youth, with my granddaughter, who cannot accept the fact that if somebody is hitting the other children, the head of the kindergarten will give her a big stick to go and hit them harder. So I'm trying to say, we have to bring ourselves back to emotional sanity. We have completely gone off the tracks, but completely. 2 days ago, no, sorry, about 3 days ago, was published in the papers that the Israeli arms have gone up from $7 billion to $9.2 billion, which is an increase of over $2 billion in the year, which is very, very considerable. Which is considerable. And where do we get that extra $2 billion from?
The sales.
It's from dealing with a lot of the African countries, where it is the norm, the tribes kill each other in the most horrible way. And I'm earning money from the death of women and children. Now, according to halakha, that money is asur b'hana'ah. You are not allowed to use that money. That is money you are not allowed to use. No rabbis talk about it. Every Shabbat they give a sermon in the synagogue, they give a talk. They write every week there's different parasha ashavua that comes out. No one talks about this. So one of the rabbis who's prepared to support it, he sends me a thing, you know what, on condition that if there is a country that we need information from, about Iran, about something, we can still give them arms, even if they kill mass, they kill, because we need that information to defeat Iran. So I reply to that rabbi, if really there is such a situation, that we need so much, we can't get it any other way, but by giving it to a mass murderer, and that the only way we can defeat Iran is without information, without Iran, then if we have to give them arms, we cannot receive one penny for those arms. Then we may know that we're not selling them for wrong reasons. The rabbi doesn't answer me. What am I trying to say? Is that we are trying to find ways to justify the fact that Israel is involved in these crimes, instead of saying, this is a no way. And here I'm talking about the rabbis who identify with me a bit. I'm not talking about the 90% of them that don't want to even know. And even they are trying to find ways why their silence is okay. What am I trying to say in two words? That if we want to become who we want to become, if we want to bless the nations of the world with our light, then we have to get back to our light. And as I said before, that light is compassion. Whether you are compassionate for somebody who's gone off the tracks spiritually, whether you're compassionate for somebody who is in physical suffering, but that is who we are. And that compassion, when that compassion rises to the level of passion, then we will break through. As long as our compassion is, I feel sorry for him, but I'm not passionate about it, then it will be, I'm sorry, but that's the end of the story. Unless we understand that we have to become passionate about our compassion, only then will we break through the wall of indifference. And then we'll become who we have to become. So yesterday I was thrown out of this place for 4 or 5 times. And I get up again and again. And I say, don't you understand we've gone off the tracks? I say it to the politicians. So Gilad Arden tells me, okay, come and speak to me in the office. So I begged you for a meeting in the office. He said, I know, but now you started shouting, you're disturbing my meeting, come to the office, we'll speak. I don't know if he's going to meet me, but he said that in front of 6 other politicians and about a couple of hundred people who are in the thing. I'm not looking to accuse. I'm not even looking to blame. I am looking to get back onto who I am. I think what we have done is much, much, much worse than all the frauds and all all the bad things that politicians are doing. This is much, much, much worse. This is assisting mass murder. You understand what I'm saying? Assisting mass murder is much worse than taking a bit of money to your pocket. Not that I'm for taking money to your pocket, but this is another level. This is ruthless. This is cruel. This is not just egoistic. I want to have more money. I want to earn a million pounds on the side. This is something much more. This is aiding mass murder. As I said before, I really believe that when we give this power to our children and to the soldiers of Sahel, you will not have a situation where a soldier is educated for 20 years to go and serve his country, and after finishing his service, an arms company will come to him and says, come and take 25,000 shekels a month to go and train murderous regimes in Africa or South America. That's madness. So again, I come from the love for my people, but we have to get back on the tracks. And we have gone off the tracks in a terrible way. We have sold our soul for money, from mass murderers. And the only way to get it back is if we understand that we not only cannot be silent, but we have to make our voices heard in the places that it's going to hurt. And that people want to ignore us till they decide they have to fight us, until they decide who are they fighting? Themselves. Their own children. In other words, if we are not capable of looking in the mirror and seeing the stains and cleaning what has to be cleaned, then we have no love for ourselves. We have no compassion for ourselves. We have to be able to look in the mirror. We cannot just put everything under the table. Certainly not assisting mass murder. And that is what we are assisting at the moment. In dozens of countries where it is in. A couple of weeks ago, the minister who was in charge of all the ceremonies in Israel decided to invite to Israel the president of Honduras to light a torch at the, festivities. I went outside and demonstrated outside the Honduras embassy, saying, "You're not welcome here." The guy is involved in killing people who fight for human rights, killing opposition people, even killing their families. I don't want him to light it. I don't want him to light, the torch here. I don't want to lie to the torture. Guatemala moved their embassy here a couple of days ago. He's also involved in killing innocent people. I do not want to buy votes at the UN by selling arms to mass murderers. I don't want their votes. I want them to vote against me because they represent values that are not my values. I want them to vote against me. I'll be happy if they vote against me. It makes it, I know, at least I know who I am, I know who they are. I don't want them to vote for me. I don't want South Sudan to vote for Israel in the United Nations. I don't want a murderer who's murdered 100,000 people in the last couple of years to vote for me. Just like I don't want Assad to vote for me. I have to know who I am. I am Am Yisrael. Am Yisrael is Am Ohev. We love. We love every human being who is born in God's image. That's who we are. This is nothing less than an abomination. It's much worse than going with your daughter-in-law. It's 50 down. And so what is the power? We have to have compassion for our own people who have gone off the tracks and believe that they can come back on the tracks. We have to believe in our people that they can come back on the tracks. And for what we're supposed to do in the world. We're supposed to give light to the world. So I don't know exactly what your activism involves or doesn't involve, but even in English, there are enough members of Parliament who speak good English that you can contact. We need a phone campaign. We need to go to their meetings and tell them that they have to address this issue. They have to understand that this is something the Jewish people demand. And maybe this is something that I speak to you here, and if I was here with an Israeli rabbi and not with Yehuda, the Israeli rabbi at this stage in the discussion will be saying, "Yeah, Eli, but we don't know the whole story. There are things that we don't know. You know, there must be interests here that we don't know. There are defense interests. Maybe we get information." And they will try to justify it in 3,000 different ways. And then at the end of the thing, I would have said everything I said, and I would have gone away, And the kids would have told, listened to their rabbi saying, yeah, well, he's only selling us parts, but we need this because of that and the other, the money and the this. And what money? And then, instead of people coming and demonstrating with me, I end up going and I'm still alone. So I've told you a bit about my frustrations, how difficult it is to get a campaign like this off the ground, the reasons it's so difficult, because the people who naturally would say, you know, this is something that has to be, you know, stopped, are just not there. They're simply not there. And none of them try and argue with me face to face. None of them try and argue and say, you got it wrong. Nobody try and say, well, the Rambam says you're allowed to, when the Rambam says you're not allowed to. None of them try and say, but even the best of the best who say, you know, you're right, it's wrong, we shouldn't be doing it, but there are other problems in Israel as well. You know, it's not the only problem in Israel, there are plenty of other problems. Why is that for this problem? Because you've got to start clean. You can't say, I'm doing good because I make agriculture in South Sudan, but I also give them arms to kill women and children. You can't say, because I do this mitzvah, I can look at the mitzvah without looking at the bad thing. No! You have companies who do good things as well. They give agriculture, and they also give arms. They say, well, we can earn money here, we earn money here, why not? No, no. Your God is money. And because your God is money, that's what allows you to do a good thing, which is nice, good to make agriculture. And also to our mass murderers. No, the mitzvah does not cancel the bad thing. Not because you did a mitzvah and you did agriculture, you could go and arm mass murderers. And they try in different ways to show how we're one. So I'm happy that we do good things. But that does not give you a right to close my eyes from helping mass murderers.